Okay. So it's good to be back in Sharon. Give it a share. This is fun. Okay. So what I want to do is, I like talking about Psak, the nature of Psak. I want to focus on one angle of Psak, and if Ray Clapper was here, he would argue with me more than most of you will, but that's okay. Deborah can report back to him, and he can yell at me tomorrow morning. He can yell at me. It's okay if he has time after he writes this tshuva. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to analyze Psak from a very particular angle. All right, I call the shir Psak Politics and the Art of Persuasion. Now, there's a perception, correct or incorrect, we'll see, that Psak is, or at least should be, a process of argumentation. Right? That you turn to someone who's more knowledgeable, and you ask them a halachic question, and they analyze the question, and they give you an answer. Now, sometimes that answer requires virtually no analysis whatsoever. They can open up a Shulchan Aruch, they can find you the halacha perhaps you didn't know, and they can just convey to you what the answer is. Simple, end of story. Sometimes it requires analysis, and admittedly, analysis can go in different ways, and we all understand that Psak can go in multiple ways, and we can talk for hours about to what extent Psak really has one correct answer. Is there one correct halachic answer to a question or not? Are there multiple truths in theory in heaven and only one truth on earth, or vice versa? But we tend to think that Psak, whatever it is fundamentally intellectual, and we would hope, or at least we think we hope, that the posek should be totally straightforward with us about what he or she is doing. Aria, I like that. What the posek is doing, and should simply make an argument. You can use this recording; it's fine. So it's okay. And that's it, right? And I fall. Oh God, I've been driving for like 5 days. You know. Okay. And that's what we tend to think Psak is. And if we were to discover that a posek was trying to, you know, use not just the intellect, but to use emotion to sway us in a certain direction, or was perhaps being even deceptive, or at least somewhat deceptive, we would at least first glance be opposed to that. We would say that's not the job of a posek. But what I want to argue here is that Psak is, at least sometimes, and should be, not just is, but should be, politics. And politics in the sense that in its very basic sense, without the ugly meaning of politics, right? Politics should be the art of governing, or in very, very simple terms, the art of getting things done. Right? In theory, good politics, if it works, should get things done. Now, if the goal of politics is to get things done, we understand that a good politician, shouldn't just be someone who conveys arguments, but should be able to convince people that they should actually follow through on those arguments. And if a politician has all the right ideas, but can't persuade anybody about this because they can't tug on their emotions, they can't actually get people to act, so then they may be very smart, they may be a great jurist, they may be a great theoretician, but they're not a good politician. Because politics at its very core is the art of getting things done. That's what it is traditionally. If you look at Source 1, which we'll read in a minute, Aristotle, in his discussion of politics, talks about what tools a politician needs, and one of them is the ability to persuade, and that's what we're going to read in a minute, the modes of persuasion, the art of persuasion, the art of rhetoric. But what I want to argue here is that Psak is politics, and that's a good thing, at least sometimes, that the posek should not be trying to be simply making an argument, but he should be using every tool, even sometimes somewhat deceptive tools, and we'll clarify that in a minute, to ensure that the right answer isn't just heard, but is actually kept. Okay, that's my thesis. Okay, so why do I think this is true? So, again, very simply, the reason I think that this is the case, and I'm going to try to prove my point as we go through, is because, if we think about it, right, what should be the role of a rabbi, of a leader, of a posek? It shouldn't just be to convey information. We all sort of understand that the role of a good rabbi, teacher, whatever the case may be, is to inspire. Now, inspire is just a nice way of saying persuade, right? Inspire is a nice way of saying that we're trying to get people to actually do something. Or we're not just trying to educate. Part of the educator's job is to inspire. Now, yes, there are these stories. I don't know whether they're true. I think of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who apparently spoke Shitati in a monotone because he didn't want anyone to be persuaded by his personality. He wanted them to be persuaded by his argument. And therefore, he chose to always speak in a monotone. And if that works, great. But I think that we have to accept and even perhaps celebrate the fact that Poskim aren't doing that. But again, what I want to argue is that they shouldn't be doing that. Okay, so what I want to look at first, before we get into examples, is a piece from Aristotle. So the first source, this is from Aristotle's Politics. This is a discussion of rhetoric. She writes as follows: of the modes of persuasion furnished by the spoken word, there are three kinds. The first kind depends on the personal character of the speaker. The second, on putting the audience into a certain frame of mind. The third, on the proof or apparent proof provided by the words of the speech itself. So Aristotle first says that when someone wants to make an argument and makes an argument, what affects whether the person he is talking to or she is talking to is convinced, there's three factors that convince that person. The first one, first and foremost, is, what does he say? The source. And this, like it or not, has been proven psychologically, right? I don't know if you've read it. Your father loves this book. Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. He discusses this at length. Human beings, to simplify our life, not consciously, subconsciously, our mind has created heuristics, has created shortcuts that we use so that we don't always have to overanalyze things, and we can use our gut, we can use our intuition for much of what we do. One of those heuristics is that we meet a person, the first impression they make tends to be the one that's almost impossible to get rid of, and once we have an impression of the person, everything they say, everything they do, if we have a good impression of that person, we are more likely to view what they do favorably, we're more likely to believe what they say. If we don't like them, we're more likely to see everything they do afterwards unfavorably and not believe anything they say. And we know this from politics, right? If you look at any of the polls after either the RNC or the DNC, you'll see that the people who are more likely to have approved of what happened in the RNC were people who already were convinced by Trump. People who opposed it already opposed Trump. The same goes for Clinton. Like it or not, that is the reality, right? The most important thing that factors into whether or not we believe someone is whether we believe the person in general, whether we like the person. Okay? Now, I think first things first is we have to admit that that's the case. And the question of whether you're going to be convinced by a posek and whether you're going to actually listen to what they say has a lot to do with whether you already trusted them going into the situation. Now, that's dangerous, right? And this, if Ray Clapper were here, he would make sure that I said this at this point, right? This is obviously dangerous because if someone has charisma but doesn't deserve to have people listening to them, or even if at some point in their life they did, right? Charisma can get to your head and you can become the type of person that no longer deserves that charisma. So charisma can be very dangerous because someone can convince people they should listen to them and then suddenly, right, you'll discover that person was in fact a bad person. So that's very dangerous. It's true, but we shouldn't deny that it is true, right? Which is exactly why it's so dangerous, right? The same reason it's dangerous is the same reason that there's a lot of potential there. If the right people have charisma and couldn't convince people, so then, right, a very simple case, right? If you take something which is black and white, right? Should you or should you not light a fire on Shabbos, right? Well, just leave it straight from a pasuk, right? Someone can convey the information that exists, that prohibition exists, there is a pasuk. If they convey that information and don't convince anybody, so they convey the information. If they manage to convince somebody that they should not light a fire on Shabbos, I think we would agree that's a good thing. Now, assuming the person doesn't then misuse his persuasive powers, we would say the fact that he's able to use his personality for good is a good thing. That's, I think, why the Gemara is so insistent that the people that we choose as our teachers should have stellar characters. As the Gemara says in source 2, if you just skip to 2, where the Gemara insists that Amar Rabbi Yochanan Ma'idich Siv Kisif Se Kohen Yishmeru Das V'Tari Vakshu Mipiyu, that the mouth of the, or the lips of the Kohen shall guard wisdom, and you shall seek Torah, teachings from his mouth, Ki Malach Hashem Tzvakot Hu, because he is a God, he is an angel of God. And the Gemara derives, Im Domeh HaRav L'Malach Hashem, if your teacher is like an angel, then Yivakshu Torah Mipiv, so then you should study Torah from him, V'im Lav Al Yivakshu Torah Mipiv, and if not, then avoid him. I think the Gemara here is on the one hand warning against the power of dangerous charisma, because you don't want to go to a teacher who in fact is not worthy of that respect, but on the other hand, is emphasizing the importance that the character of the person you're talking to has on his influence or her influence over you. Therefore, if you're going to find someone who can inspire you and can persuade you, it should be someone who's a good person. So, dangerous as it is, it's clearly true that effective poskim, effective leaders, have a personality that convinces people. So that's point one. The second thing he says is that what convinces people to actually follow what you're doing is emotion. Right? If someone says something in a monotone, you're less likely to actually listen than if they can get you into it, if they can inspire you, if they can tug on your heartstrings. The third most important thing when someone's trying to convince you to do something is the actual content of the argument. Now, we may not like that, but Aristotle, thousands of years ago, noted this was the case. And he continues, he says, we believe good men more fully and more readily than others. This is true, generally, whatever the question is, and absolutely true where exact certainty is impossible and opinions are divided. He says this is always true, even on facts. And for sure on things which aren't facts. Right, for sure on, let's say, psak, where it could go either way. There might be multiple possibilities, right? Facts, a really persuasive person, maybe he or she can get you to believe that 2 plus 2 is 5. Probably not, right? A really persuasive person, maybe they could. But when there are multiple possibilities, and it's not clear, so then, the more persuasive the person, the more likely you are to believe what they say, regardless of whether they have the better argument, because it's not like either side can prove conclusively what's right or what's wrong. And psak, that's for sure true, as the Ramban writes in his Hakdama to the Milchamos Hashem, psak is not like math. By definition, it never has 100-0. Legal argumentation is always a question of probabilities. If it's a question of probabilities, so that opens the possibility to be persuaded in either direction, which makes the personality of the posik that much more important. Aristotle continues, this kind of persuasion, like the others, should be achieved by what the speaker says, not by what people think of his character before he begins to speak. Right? It shouldn't be this way, but it is. Right? It is not true, as some writers assumed in their treatises on rhetoric, that the personal goodness revealed by the speaker contributes nothing to his power of persuasion. On the contrary, his character may almost be called the most effective means of persuasion he possesses. Secondly, persuasion may come through the hearers when the speech stirs their emotions. Our judgments when we are pleased and friendly are not the same as when we are pained and hostile. It is toward producing these effects, as we maintain, that present-day writers on rhetoric direct the whole of their efforts. This subject shall be treated in detail when we come to speak of the emotions. And thirdly, persuasion is effected through the speech itself, when we have proved a truth or an apparent truth by means of the persuasive argument suitable to the case in question. There are, then, these three means of effecting persuasion. The man who is to be in command of them must, it is clear, be able to, one, reason logically, two, understand human character and goodness in their various forms, and three, to understand the emotions, that is, to name them, describe them, to know their causes and the way in which they are excited. It thus appears that rhetoric is an offshoot of dialectic and also of ethical studies. Ethical studies may fairly be called political, and for this reason, rhetoric masquerades as political science, and the profession of it is political experts, sometimes from want of education, sometimes from ostentation, sometimes owing to the other human failings, etc. He notes that rhetoric, the ability to speak and persuade, is critical to politics. That means that sometimes people who are good at persuading end up being considered good politicians, even if they're not actually good at doing anything. But be that as it may, we can't deny that at the end of the day, critical to the science called politics, to this world of persuasion, is the ability to persuade. And if psak is not just conveying information, but is telling someone what you think they should do, then it would follow, I think, that a posek should also be able to use those same tools to not just convey information, but to persuade the person listening to listen to what they're saying. And Aristotle continues, but we won't read it right now. Okay, so that's my thesis. What I want to do from here on in, though, is to prove it. Because I know there's a lot of people, right, several in this room, and I'm sure many others not in this room, right, who would be very hesitant about putting out the thesis that I just said. Namely, that the job of a posek should be, or at least often is, to persuade rather than just argue. Because we like to think that we're intelligent enough that all we need is a persuasive argument, not persuasive in the sense like rhetoric and emotions and personality cults, but simply that someone should convey information, and if it's true, we should listen. But I don't think that's how life actually works, right? And I think recognizing that poskim live in the real world and are dealing with real people means that we shouldn't expect our poskim, our leaders, our those making halachic decisions, to be robots, because that's a misunderstanding of what halacha can be, should be, and I think de facto is. Yeah.
Does this persuasion come at the expense of epistemological value of the content?
So that's where we're going to go. Okay. But what do I mean, right? So what do I mean when I say it's important for the posek to be a politician, to be able to persuade? So that can mean multiple things. Now, sometimes it's not going to come at the cost of the argument, right? Now, here I think this is the least controversial. If I could show you a case where a posek made a straightforward argument, was totally honest about what he was saying, but he happened to also use good rhetoric to try to pull on your heartstrings in addition to convincing you, I think most people would not be too opposed to that. Now, you still might ask me, then why bother doing that? Why don't you just write and convey information? So let me give a case which is an extreme, where I think we can all agree that it was necessary for the poskim to pull on the heartstrings and not just make pure rational arguments. But this is going to be a case where the poskim in question aren't lying to you, they're totally straightforward, they're not being deceptive, they're putting all their cards on the table. They're just also using, right, if we go back to Aristotle's three elements of persuasion, they're not only using arguments, they are, they're also using emotion and personality or authority. They're using all three to get their point across, okay? So that, I think, is going to be the least controversial, right? The fact that poskim, when they're not sacrificing anything intellectually, should use emotion if necessary to make sure that the right result is kept. Okay? So a very good example is in number 3. This is from a kuntres. This is from a pamphlet called Ma'amar Yira Tehara. This is a Yoni might know this because I've mentioned it in Ariel. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know if you were there this year. I've quoted it before. It's a fascinating pamphlet put out by the Haredi World a few years ago on OCD, or specifically OCD as it is expressed itself in religion. Technical term being scrupulosity. Okay? OCD tends to express it, can express itself in religion, then it's called scrupulosity. And there's a good reason why OCD expresses itself in religion, especially in halacha, which is that halacha is a little bit neurotic, right? The example I like giving to this is there's a fascinating book called Sanity and Sanctity, written by two psychiatrists who work in the Haredi community in Me'ev Sha'arim. The point of the book is to convince fellow psychiatrists and psychologists and mental health professionals of the importance of understanding the culture of their patients before they determine whether or not their patients are in fact suffering. So they give the following example. They say, imagine the following two people. One is named Jack. Every day, when he comes back home, he walks in the house, he takes his shoes, and he immediately pours boiling water on top of his shoes. And then he has a very specific ritual. He goes to his sink and he washes his hands in boiling hot water that pains his hands for exactly 15 minutes with the same antibacterial soap, which is the strongest as recommended by doctors, every day. And every time he walks out of the house, and then he immediately puts on plastic gloves before he touches any of the doorknobs in his house because he's petrified of germs. And he has this ritual down to the smallest details of how he avoids germs because he's petrified of germs. This person exhibits textbook case OCD. Okay? Person 1. Person 2, Yaakov, wakes up in the morning every day. And as soon as he gets up in the morning, he mumbles a little ancient Hebrew prayer thanking God. And then he takes a cup, which holds at least 4+ ounces, according to different opinions, has no holes in it, is clean, and takes the water, and he washes his right hand, and then his left, and then his right, and then his left, and his right, and then his left, in the exact same order every day. And then he says a blessing before he dries his hand, and then he dries his hands, and then he can use the bathroom. Then he says another blessing. Then he says the exact same 15 blessings that he says every single morning. And we can go on. The second person sounds neurotic to an outsider, except we know that within the culture of Halachic Judaism, the person is doing exactly what's normal. So the authors of this book argue, right, that it's critical to understand the difference between, right, to understand the culture of the patient to figure out whether what they're doing is normal by this, their own societal standards, so you don't impose your own idea of what obsession looks like. Obsession means an aberration from the community in which the person suffering lives in, not an aberration based on your society. Okay? But because halacha does have the possibility of expressing itself that way, for example, not Yaakov, but a different person, Reuven, who, instead of doing that, or maybe he does that also, when he says the bracha, right, he's so convinced that he needs to say it with kavana, with intent, that if he doesn't say it with intent, he keeps repeating it, and he ends up spending 45 minutes every morning saying the bracha on washing his hands because he never thinks he has enough intent. Now that is an aberration from his own community, because that's against halacha. That would be saying a series of brachot levatalot, of blessings in vain. So that is a neurosis, right? That's an expression of OCD, of scrupulosity, because it's, right, an unhealthy expression of religious rigor, which is actually incorrect, which is actually false, okay? But because halacha is the way it is, OCD is a problem in the from community, as it is everywhere, maybe even a greater problem. So this pamphlet came out called Yirat Tehorah, which is aimed at the person, probably teenage boy, suffering from OCD, from scrupulosity. Okay? So this is one paragraph. Number three is one paragraph taken from this pamphlet. And he says, they write to this person. It's written by two people, collecting the psakim of the Haredi Gedolim, of the leaders. And they say as follows. Yedanu me'od harbe mine nervin. If you didn't catch what that was. Nervin, right? We know nerves. We understand nerves. Right? V'amestaif, it's OCD. Okay? We understand your nerves. V'amestaif b'sharni anem ha'she'en min ha'kavod lefartam. And everything that comes because of it. And we don't want to go into details. So let it be as if we explain them. And then you should learn for everything else. And he says, look, we understand the complexity of people who have OCD. And we understand the stubbornness that they develop. And they don't listen to everyone. They're always the ones who are right. They're always right. And they know more than the gedolim, more than the leaders. Or they think they fear God more. And therefore, they don't want to rely on the gedolim. Afra lipumayhu. We should stuff dirt in their mouths, right? How dare you say such a thing? You know better than the Gedolim. Aval min ha'nisayon yadua, right? From research we know. From testing we know. Shekol ilush nistabchu bioter. These people it's so complicated for them. So complex. Adasher giyu mayim ad nafesh, to the point where they're basically drowning. Right? They have water coming up to their mouth. And by time they recognize their mistake, it's gotten so bad that it's nearly impossible to get out of it. He said, but you think you shouldn't listen to the gedolim, to the rabbis? They're telling you, don't repeat that bracha 50 times. Right? You said it once, that's enough. You don't need kavana. Don't be so obsessive. You're saying a bracha levatalo, but you're not listening to the rabbis? You're not listening to the gedolim? He's actually commenting on a much more surprising psak. And he quotes here from Rabbi Yashiv. I didn't put it here, but I'll say the psak. Rabbi Yashiv said to these people, if you are suffering from scrupulosity and it expresses itself in tefillah, and you can't extricate from yourself from it. So what should you do until you're cured? Don't daven. It's usher for you to daven. It's usher for you to daven until you're cured. Right? It's a fascinating pamphlet if you read it. Fascinating document there. Okay. So he said, I know that the person listening is not going to listen to me because they always think they're right. It's the nature of the disorder that they always think they're right. So he says, Ukfarn Sevino, but how could you not listen? But we know, Vasita Kholasher Yerucha, Vafil Yomalchal Smoshu, Yamin, Valas, Yamin Shu Smo. The Torah says, listen to the rabbis, even if they right is left or left is right. Kholshaken al Yamin Shu Yamin Val Smoshu Smo. For sure, if right is right and left is left, is Mamash Khiyuv Gamur Midoraisa, and that's a biblical obligation. Three exclamation points. Right? Vikatava Chinuch, and then he quotes the source for this, etc. Okay. We'll stop there on this piece. Now, this piece, the argument is straightforward. Right? The argument halachically is straightforward. Is, you're breaking halacha, you should not break halacha. Right? What you're doing is wrong. Right? That's, all their cards are on the table. But, they also use the modes of persuasion that Aristotle talked about, all three of them. Right? They insist, first of all, on pointing to personalities who might affect them, right? Reminding people of the power of the Gedolim, right? Which in the Haredi world is particularly powerful because of the notion of Das Torah. And they use, right, harsh rhetoric, right, or charged language to try to get the people to understand how bad the path they've gone on is to try to make them change. Now, this case, I would say that this is a perfect example of why a posek should be, at its best, a politician. Because if you turn to this person suffering from OCD, he often, or she often, knows that what we're doing is wrong. And it takes a lot to push them to seek treatment and to actually act based on the treatment. And if you just tell them you are suffering, you can be totally honest with them, but the chances of them listening to you are basically nil. But if you have a relationship with them, and you can pull on their heartstrings, and you can actually tug both on their intellect and on their emotions, the chances that you can actually help this person improve are, I don't know how much better, but definitely better than if you try to convince them in a monotone, right? You are suffering, you should do this, and you didn't try to use every mechanism that you had to convince them to do what needed to be done. So I like using this piece, because here, but if I asked you in a vacuum, if you have someone suffering from mental health illness and you can affect them, right, should you use every mean without being dishonest, without using them to help them? The answer would be yes. So sometimes that responsibility devolves on the posek. Because sometimes, as in this case, there are halachic shailas involved, so the posek's involved. And just like you wouldn't expect the person's parent to be purely rational to them and not try to use their parental connection to help their child, right? Both the authority component of it, the personality component of it, and the emotional component of your mother telling you, you're making me cry watching you suffer like this. You wouldn't expect the person's mother to speak in a monotone to try to convince their child to change their ways. Sometimes poskim act in the exact same way. They have to get something done. And here, these poskim are trying to convince the person suffering from OCD to follow these psakim, which are difficult to follow for this person, so they use every tool in the toolbox.
Aren't you taking a case where posek in this article, where they're acting like doctors? They
yeah.
To heal him.
Correct. I'm purposely taking an extreme case. Right? I'm purposely taking an extreme case where the posek is also acting as a doctor. The posek is also acting as the decisor, right? He's issuing.
Where is he acting like a posek?
Well, that was what I told you, what I didn't put here.
We know that he's not allowed to.
Oh, but that's what I'm saying. He's building also under Rabbi Yashiv Psak that the person is exempt from davening, right? Which is not obvious. Right? That's already a halachic decision that has to be made.
Yeah, but for instance, Rabbi Yashiv Psak is one that's not necessarily directed to the OCD person himself, but to all of us. Telling us, if we know an OCD, tell the OCD.
No, it's a psak for the purpose.
He's just giving a general psak.
So no, actually, right? Because the authors of this this pamphlet actually went to the Haredi Gadolim to put this together, right? So it actually is directed. I mean, it's not like a generic psak, right? This was part of a concerted effort to develop a shita that would speak to them. So it, in that sense, it is. Yeah, Deborah.
To what extent does this kind of emotional appeal when it's printed in a pamphlet?
Right, so that's always the question, right? Does it work when it's in a, right, when it's written? So obviously in the written word, it's not quite as effective, but there is that qualification, right? Obviously, personal interaction, which is for sure true, right? I think most people, right, if you said this about a shul rabbi who's acting in his pastoral role, understand that a shul rabbi has a pastoral role and a role as a posek, and therefore he's not expected to talk in a monotone. He's expected to be personable, as opposed to the posek writing, right? Which is why I like this example. I don't know how effective it would be, but if there's even one person in the world to who this was effective, it was worth adding the rhetoric and adding the connection to the Gedolim and adding whatever it took, right? He was totally honest. They were the authors are totally honest, right? But they don't suffice with, right, a cold monotonal argument, because any hope they have of this written pamphlet helping someone lies in the fact that it can tug on their emotions or can convince the person who was talking to the OCD patient, right, too, of the urgency of the situation, right? Or whatever, right? I mean, whatever role they're acting, and for sure, right, personal interaction is helpful. Okay, so that's one example. But there, I think, all of us can basically agree that this was a good thing, right? The person was totally being honest. So he's acting a politician, quote-unquote, in the sense that he's trying to convince the person to actually follow his psak. Let me just try to get to the next example, right? But he's not doing anything dishonest whatsoever. Okay, so there I think we can agree that as long as the person doesn't misuse his power of personality, he should use it for good as long as he's being totally honest, right? He's not trying to be deceptive, he's being totally straightforward, but he's also using persuasive tools, that would be a good thing, right? This is an extreme win. We can argue about when he should use persuasive tools and when he shouldn't, but the fact that there are some cases where he should not just be honest, but he should also try to persuade, I think is obvious. Okay,